Welcome to Stout Audio, produced at Spruce Knob Studios in Middletown Springs, Vermont. Stout brings you stories and ideas about the things you've seen a thousand times but never really looked at. Welcome to the show. Here's your host, Herb Childress. Today's story is another from a series called A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Short stories about men who had to make themselves new as the deals were broken, when their reliable landscapes dissolved around them. My dad and older brothers were all hunters, and I remember that every fall during deer season, our town had a dozen or two unlicensed butchers open up shop in their garages to process all the venison. Nowadays, that's all overseen by the FDA and the USDA and the State Department of Health. You have to bring your deer to a licensed facility to get it processed. Back in the day, you shot it and ate it. You died or you didn't. And I always wondered about those amateur butcher shops, one of the dozen ways that a working-class family might have added some income to its year. Not unlike filling the freezer with venison instead of going to the meat counter at the Spartan Grocery. So, here's a story set in Gaylord, Michigan, in 1974. It's called Off Tag. Chuck recognized Peter's truck in the yard by its off-rhythm sound. There wasn't a mechanic born who could keep the timing right on that thing. Chuck pulled his barn coat from its peg outside the kitchen, went out to the breezeway, onto the gravel pad in front of the garage where Peter had pulled in. The old truck had lost all the paint on its upper surfaces. The hood and roof were both brown with rust, fading to dull, chipped peppermint green down the sides. The circular letters had long since popped off the hood, leaving their rusted rivet holes as faint evidence. The truck now read Heverlet. "Glad you called," Chuck said, as the old man slid down from the bench seat. "Maisie and me is about to go over to Lisa's, see the grandkids. You'd have missed me." "Yeah, well, damn near missed this one," Peter said, walking to the back of the truck. "Gut shot her. Had to track her half a mile. Weren't for the blood trail in the snow, I'd have lost her complete." He swung the capper up and the tailgate down, pulling the deer's carcass out of the truck bed by its front legs. "Geez, hang on a second, would you? Let me open up the shop." Chuck went to the garage, bent to lift the sliding door. Once the springs engaged to pull the door up the tracks, he went into the darkness and found the light switch. The reassuring buzz of the long fluorescent troffers was always a source of comfort on cold nights. He hadn't had a car in the garage for 15 years. It was all dedicated to fall process. Sinks, broad tables, a butcher paper dispenser on the wall with its huge brown roll, knives, an electric meat grinder, two second-hand walk-in refrigerators, an oval galvanized farm trough on casters, and an iron pipe frame above it to hang deer for bleed-out and gutting. He pulled a gambrel down from a peg on the wall, laid it on the cutting bench. Then he walked back to the truck and said to Peter, "I'll go backwards." Peter pulled. Chuck waited until the ribcage had cleared the tailgate edge, then reached in and took the two back legs. Female. Light. Maybe 80, 90 pounds even before being dressed. It sagged between them like a hammock. "Didn't know you had a doe permit this year," Chuck said, as he shuffled backward toward the light of the garage. "Yep, signed by Mr. Winchester himself," the old man grinned as he followed through Chuck's tracks in the powder snow. "Permit number 3030. "Oh, God damn it, Peter, I told you last year not to bring me off-tag doe. You want me closed?" "Well, come on, Chuck. I only had one day in the field this year. I can't be having the freezer empty. Barely keep the damn heat on. It's deer meat or hungry." This was the third straight year that Peter had brought him an illegally shot doe. He never field-dressed them, had to drag them out of the woods as soon as they were dead to reduce the chances of being spotted by a game warden. Chuck had probably processed 50 off-tag doe for different men in the past dozen years, and always imagined each would be the one that closed his operation. But he did them anyway. Venison was a staple of a lot of local tables, and Chuck knew that he had a responsibility to his neighbors that went beyond his responsibility to Michigan Fish and Game. Gaylord's one big factory, Bates & Cooper, had shut down over 10 years back, leaving 1,200 men who had never found other work, Machinists and warehousemen and linemen left with nothing to fit their hands except rifles and fishing rods, cigarettes and beer bottles. Michigan's industrial success had been a thin veneer of comfort for a few decades, now flaking away to re-expose the grueling wilderness subsistence of the French trappers and the Chippewa gone before. Peter was among the industrial discards, in his 60s now, a bad hip, a missing joint on his index finger, one of hundreds of men field-marked by his work. Chuck knew Peter wasn't exaggerating his need for the venison to get him and Ida through the winter. His summer perch and bluegills were probably about gone. He'd be ice fishing as soon as Otsego Lake got to 4 inches. Chuck resigned himself to the task. Ready? They swung the deer away from the side table, then back and up. The galvanized sheet metal tabletop banged down onto its frame from the landing. At least the deer looked like it had been healthy. Clear coat, clear eye, no visible wounds or scars except for the one Peter had inflicted. And it was cold enough out that the animal's body temperature had dropped fast, so there probably wouldn't be much loss. He got the gambrel around the doe's hind legs, lifted it with a gaffing hook up to clip onto the scale suspended from a beam. He tugged at both legs to be sure the doe wouldn't slip from the curved steel arms, walked to the tie-down next to the garage door, and pulled the rope until the scale, gambrel, and deer all rose clear of the table. Peter looked at the scale. 86, he said, then laughed. Sure enough, 86'd it. Chuck thumped the doe's belly with his palm, got a mostly hollow sound. Hadn't eaten much recently. So after I dress it, it's going to be 60 or so. Meat weight, 25 pounds maybe. How do you want it? Ground, whole thing. Chuck understood. Survival food. No steaks or roasts, nothing for pleasure, but cheaper to cut and more efficient to strip all the last meat off bones and tendons. It might get closer to 30 then. 55 cents a pound, wrapped pound apiece. How soon? Today's Sunday, Tuesday. I'll call you. His father had taught him how similar butchering was to barbering. Just pay attention to the natural curves and boundaries, and don't try to make it something it isn't. Chuck had followed his dad into both lines of work, taking over his single-chair barbershop and taking up the annual 6-week second job of deer processing. Gaylord probably had 20 of each, the barbers all licensed and the deer butchers not, filling their roles in the small-town ecology just like the deer and the hunters. The kids, if they were smart and lucky enough to not die in Vietnam, had gone off to college and then to Grand Rapids or Lansing or someplace with office jobs. Even Chuck's own daughter Lisa had gone to Ferris State and then married Richard and went with him to run his insurance bureau in Petoskey. Gaylord was increasingly populated by the elderly and the not all that bright, neither of which had much money. There were a few younger men who went to the unisex salons to make their hair look like Starsky and Hutch, and a few hunters who took their meat to Staley's for custom cuts and sausage and jerky, but most of Gaylord was old and tired and still trying to adjust to gas at a buck a gallon instead of 38 cents, and the barbers and processors stayed busy. If he were 20 years younger, he'd try to make a go of it himself, over to Traverse City or down to Kalamazoo. But the Depression and the war had both put college out of reach, and his education had come from the newspapers, the half-price paperbacks he bought at Vanessa's junk shop, and 30 years of listening to stories from the chair. He kept a logbook of each permitted deer brought into the garage, the hunter's name, date, hunting license number, dressed weight, sex, approximate age. That book was for fish and game. He kept a second logbook in the house for himself, hunter's name, processed weight, cuts and packaging, invoice. The deer had gotten Lisa through college, had paid for a few trips down to Tiger Stadium in the years since, had built their savings to the point where a new car would be possible maybe in the next couple of years. He hadn't raised the price of a haircut or deer processing in 6 years. "Can't believe what they're charging for a haircut over at Jack's now," the old men would say as they waited their turn for his chair. And Chuck knew to translate that as, "Thank you. We appreciate what you do for us." Chuck had worked all day and into the evening on Sunday, and after he closed the shop on Monday as well. The season had been good so far. The deep snow brought the deer out of the forest for food, kept him still as they browsed, and slowed their escape and provided a blood trail. He'd processed $3 and a permitted doe along with Peter's deer, about 210 pounds of finished venison in 2 days. He was grateful to head for his shower on Monday night, looking forward to both cleanliness and warmth. The nighttime temps were below zero, inside the garage about 10 above. Maisie watched him as he stripped down in the mudroom, dumped his coveralls into a hamper, and flexed his hands to recover some feeling in them. "When are you finally going to be smart enough to put in a freezer curtain and a heater?" she asked, for about the 1,000th time. He knew to translate that, too, as, "I love you, and I hate that you make yourself so uncomfortable. I don't want you to get hurt because you're so cold." "Eh, just be another thing to get in the way and have to keep clean," he said, without aggravation. "Well, you get yourself good and warm before you come into bed," she said, and he smiled to himself as he translated that as well. He met Peter after work on Tuesday at the VFW, moved a cardboard box full of wrapped meat from his trunk to Peter's truck bed. The temperature was near zero, so the meat was getting a no-cost head start toward freezing. He had ground all but 5 pounds. The backstrap was so pretty that he'd cut 4 8-ounce steaks from it, along with 3 pounds of chopped flank for stew meat, not charging for the extra labor. "That was a strong dough," he said. "More muscle than we thought. 34 pounds total. Call it 1850. "That ought to get me through till spring," Peter said. "Thanks. Come on in. I'll buy you a beer." They walked into the one-story cinder block building, down the long corridor past the rarely used meeting rooms, and into the one VFW room that mattered, the bar. At 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, there were 8 or 9 other customers, the same members as every other night. Bill, Navy, Pacific, 1943-44. Joey, Army Infantry, Europe, 1943-45. Earl, Army Air Corps, Europe, 1940-44. Nunn, from Korea or Vietnam. A year or so ago, a Marine Corps vet in his 20s had come in for a beer and to ask about membership, and had left one step shy of a fistfight after Donnie had told him, "VFW stands for Vets Who Fucking Won." Now the bar was occupied only by those men in their 50s and 60s who'd set fire to Japanese encampments with flamethrowers, who'd watched their friends torn to pieces when the kamikaze flew into the pilot house of a destroyer, who had loaded incendiary bombs onto planes bound for Dresden. The stories that came out about midnight. Fifth beer stories. Stories never heard outside this room, never heard by wives or pastors or any who hadn't stories of their own. Stories not in congruence with the Christmas lights strung above the bar. At this earlier hour, other stories came more easily. Stories of daily grievance, of bureaucratic delays or equipment prematurely failed. Stories of small individual triumphs, of ingenuity and resourcefulness. Chuck and Peter walked into one such tale, Bobby Tetro recounting his afternoon at Teeter Ford's parts counter. The newcomers were acknowledged with a glance, just enough to nod and recognize that they were trustworthy, not slowing the report in mid-telling. "So the kid pulls out a rebuilt," Bobby said, "and as soon as I had it out of the box, I could tell the throttle linkage was bent. So I said, 'Listen, this crap ain't even going to last me 6 months.' So the kid looks at it, and he puts his thumb in the middle of the linkage, and he bends it back straight. Thinks he worked a fucking miracle. I says, 'Come on, if you can bend it back that easy, it's going to bend right back out again as soon as I pull the throttle cable.'" Dave laughed. "Autolite ain't never right. You ought to put an Edelbrock on it. Best thing I ever did." "I ain't putting a Kraut carburetor on my car," Bobby said. "Yeah, well, Krauts and Japs, that's all we're going to have for cars in 10 years, Steve said. "Beat them in the battlefield, give it all back in jobs." "Yeah, did you see there's a Datsun dealer over in Traverse now?" said Stan. "Moved in where Miller Plymouth used to be. Fucking disgusting. Hope it burns to fucking ground." Peter came back over to Chuck with 2 strohs and said, "Come on, sit with me down the other end for a minute. I got something I want to talk to you about." They walked down to the far end of the curve, half a dozen stools away from the chatter of carburetors and imported cars and ungrateful know-nothing young people. Peter got one cheek up onto the stool, a foot on the brass rail, and raised his bottle. "So first off, thanks for taking my dough. I know it's trouble for you, but it's tight out there, you know." "I know, Peter. It's okay. I hope it does you good." "Well, it looks like it's going to go further this winter than before. Ida's got cancer, both lungs and her spine too. They're saying 2 weeks. She's been having a hard time for a few months, but we just learned yesterday. Oh, Peter. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry to hear it. How is she doing? Is she in pain? Yeah, some in her back, but mostly she says she feels like she's underwater, like she's suffocating. Chuck didn't know Ida well, but knew her enough to picture her still dark hair, square glasses, broad smile. He couldn't imagine her suffering. Couldn't imagine Peter suffering alongside her. So what are you going to do? Are you going to take her to Lansing? Nah, doctor said there'd nothing to do. Too far along. They're going to give her new morphine to keep her comfortable, but no way she's going to get to Christmas. Peter sounded calm, but couldn't meet Chuck's eyes. The same reaction he'd had a few years back when their son Walt had been killed on a job site over in Port Huron. The voice and face of a man familiar with grief. A man for whom grief was worn like a winter coat, heavy, but not unexpected. Chuck said, are you going to be okay for money? I mean, you got doctors and a funeral. You know the post has a fund. We could put up a can here and get some donations. Well, that's what I need to talk to you about. Now, Peter raised his chin, looked Chuck straight in the face. We're done with doctors. Don't make no sense to have Clark taking her temperature and checking her pulse when she's going to be gone anyway. She ain't going to pass faster or slower one way or the other. But I did a little asking around, and it looks like the mortuary is going to be $1,500, maybe $2,000, no matter how careful I am. That's a half a year of Social Security. He brief catch in his voice. I guess it's more than that. With Ida gone, the $300 a month's going to go down to $150. So I'm going to need some help. We got nobody else. Sure. I'll do whatever you need me to do. Maisie and I don't have a lot of money, but we're happy to help out. Well, it ain't that. Chuck and Maisie sat at their kitchen table, each with two hands around their coffee mugs for the warmth and because it was something to hang on to and keep them stable. Maisie had been over to see Ida on Wednesday afternoon. They knew each other some, weren't close, but no one else was either. Peter and Ida had no kids left, siblings gone, weren't churchgoers. The wife of a husband's friend from the post was as close to next of kin as Ida would come to. So she's going to take all of her new morphine at once on Friday morning. She says her doctor knows, and he told her she'd be done in less than an hour, and that it would be pretty peaceful. Peter doesn't know yet. She's telling him tonight. Jesus. I know. So you and I and Peter have tomorrow to do whatever preparation we're going to do. Chuck sighed. Make up a sign for me. I'm going to have to be closed tomorrow. Friday, too. I'll tape it to the door later. I'm going to the garage, get some stuff together. He reached from his mug, put a hand atop hers. Thank you. This isn't your business. Well, that's not yours either, but he trusts you, and she trusts him. She smiled at him. Go on, get to work. It'll do you good. On Thursday, Chuck and Peter worked together to dig the grave back on the edge of Peter's yard at the woods. First, they shoveled a 12-by-12-foot area of the yard clear of snow. Then Chuck took out 7-foot-by-3-foot in squares of sod, and Peter laid them neatly aside. Once they had the trim size of the hole, Chuck used Peter's ice fishing auger to break up the soil a foot deep at a time, then shoveled it out, Peter taking wheelbarrows to a growing pile of dirt and stones at the snow's edge. Once the hole was 4 feet deep, Chuck went down inside with a stepladder, laid 2x4s at the bottom to make a slatted wooden base for Ida to rest on. Then he climbed back out, and he and Peter went to work on building a scaffold above the grave, assembling pipes and brackets, and finally hanging a pulley at the center. The two men walked into the house for mid-afternoon coffee and warmth, shedding their snowsuits in the mudroom before going into the kitchen. Maisie was holding two dresses, one red and one yellow. What do you think, Petey? Ida gurgled, her voice quiet and wet. Maisie held the yellow dress in front of Ida in her armchair, smoothing it across her lap, then the red. Yellow, Peter said softly. Springtime. Yellow, Ida said. I'd like that. Good, Maisie said. I'll come back and iron that in a little bit. Peter, let's you and I go do a couple things. Let Chuck do his work. They walked off to another room, and Chuck picked up a sheet, draping it across Ida from the neck and closing it up tight in the back with two clothespins. "So, Ida," he said, unzipping his small leather barber's kit, "tell me about how you want your hair fixed." Ida pulled a magazine from the side table, turned to a page that had a corner folded down. He saw a photo of Mia Farrow, her hair straight and boyishly short. She tapped her finger on the picture, a little sheepish.
"I always wanted to try that, but I was never brave enough to do it."
"Well, no time like the present, then," Chuck said, and set to work. Maisie had made a dinner of the venison steaks with potatoes au gratin, and Peter made Crown Royal old fashions. He passed drinks around and tapped his glass against Ida's. "You should have done that hairdo years ago. You're the belle of the ball." Ida smiled at Peter and then at Chuck. She was wearing the red dress that evening.
"I never trusted Doris enough to have her do it."
She coughed, damp and brittle, in lieu of laughing.
"She charges by the roller, I think. She'd have fainted if I'd have showed her that picture."
"Well, I never would have thought of it myself, but you look terrific," he said. And Chuck thought, maybe it's only now, at the end, when we don't have to translate each other, when we can hear and say what we want. After dinner, Maisie and Chuck drove home through the dark streets, and she said, "I want you to cut my hair. Short."
"Really?"
"Yeah, I don't want to wait to try it until I got one day left." The next morning, Ida beamed from her bed when she saw Maisie's pixie cut.
"Aren't you just the cutest thing?" she rasped.
"Well, you inspired me, sweetie. Once I saw yours, I had to get one just like it."
"He does do good work," Ida said, smiling at Chuck. "He's a good man."
She turned her eyes up to Peter, held his hand.
"Like this one."
She wore the yellow dress, was barefoot, looked to be both 80 and 20 years old at once. Peter said, "Why don't you two go on and have breakfast somewhere? Ida and I have a couple things to take care of. Be back around 11 or so, okay?" Chuck and Maisie went off to Country Griddle, where it seemed half the women in the restaurant came up to her and complimented her on her hair. Once they got back to the house, they saw Dr. Clark's black Lincoln in the driveway, its Caduceus license plate. They went into the house as he was coming out of the bedroom, closing his bag. "Didn't expect it would go quite so rapidly," he said with a gentle smile. "Cancer can be unpredictable, especially close to the end." "I left the death certificate with Peter. No infectious or communicable diseases. You may lay the body to rest as your faith and customs indicate. Thank you, both, for helping her pass peacefully." He took his coat from a peg and departed. They walked into the bedroom, saw Peter next to Ida on the bed. She was still beautiful in her short hair and radiant yellow dress, and he just laid next to her and cried softly, holding her hand. Chuck and Maisie stood in the doorway, holding hands themselves, and waited until Peter rose from the bed and composed himself. He tugged his trousers down at the thigh to straighten them. "Do what you need to do," he said to Chuck, sniffling. "She ain't here now." Maisie took his hand and led him from the bedroom. Ida was still warm and soft. Chuck figured he had about half an hour, maybe 40 minutes. He slipped a pair of shoes onto her feet, tied them, put a dollop of mastic glue on the palm of her right hand, placed it firmly atop her left, and pressed her hands demurely together at her waist, holding them together until the glue had set. Had a sudden realization, stepped into the kitchen for a moment. "Peter, you want her wedding ring?" "No, she should have it." He nodded and walked back into the bedroom, rolled two bath towels into long cylinders, placed them tight against the outside of each leg so that her feet were pointed straight up and her knees didn't roll outward. He put a small dab of glue on the inside of one eyelid, spread it with a flat stick, pulled it down and held it in place for 2 minutes, then the other. He tipped her head back slightly so that her chin was straight ahead and not dropped down toward her chest, put a touch of glue between her lips, then wrapped an elastic bandage from under her chin to over the crown of her head, tying a knot at the top to hold her mouth closed. He went into the kitchen, washed his hands, made a pot of coffee.
In the next room, Peter was showing a box of photos to Maisie, still crying gently. Maisie snugged up against his side on the couch and holding his hand. Chuck drank his coffee, brought a pair of mugs into the living room, and went back to the bedroom. He gently eased a towel away from one leg, and Ida's knees stayed upright. He put it back, did the same on the other side. Same result. She was stiffening now, and would be easier to handle. He undid the bandage and reset her hair. It was a cute haircut. He propped the wooden stretcher he had made against the foot of the bed, pulled a nightstand to its base to wedge it in place. He undid the sheets from all four corners of the mattress and slid Ida slowly down so that she gradually rested on the stretcher. He worked for a couple of minutes to set her straight and square once again and then went to the living room. "It's time, Peter," he said, handing him a coat and picking up Maisie's and then his own. Once they were dressed for the weather, the two men returned to the bedroom. Chuck bent down to lift the bottom grips of the stretcher. "I'll go backwards," he said. He stood straight. Peter lifted the top grips, and they walked slowly through the house, Maisie opening doors ahead of them. They walked out to a picnic table that they'd placed next to the grave. Maisie and Peter had covered it with a flannel-fitted sheet and arrayed it with Christmas lights, yellow and red, blue and green. They eased her gently onto the table, onto the lights. She was illuminated in the late afternoon dusk. Maisie took a balsam fir wreath wrapped in tiny white lights, lifted Ida's head gently, slid the wreath beneath it to form an aura. They all stood back, quiet. Dusk faded to night, the lights of veneration mirrored by stars in the clear night sky. "Finally," Peter said, "she always did love Christmas." They unplugged the cords and wrapped her in the sheet, lights and all, and used the pulley with the ropes tied off to the sheet's corners to swing her over above the grave and slowly lower her down to the wooden platform at the bottom. Peter and Chuck alternated shovels for almost 40 minutes until the hole was filled. Once they were done, Peter said, "Go on home, you two. I'll put the sod down this weekend." Maisie hugged him close, Chuck as well. And then Chuck said, "Wait a minute, one last thing." He went back to his car, returned with an envelope from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. "I got lucky in the lottery this year, got a doe permit. But I'm going to be so busy with processing this season, I don't think I'm going to have a spare minute to get into the woods. Why don't you take another day or two out in the field, see what you can bring in? I'll process it for you." That, finally, broke Peter's composure. He nodded, unable to speak, turned away from them. His shoulders shook. Maisie gathered him in, and they walked him into the house, helped him out of his coat and boots, and set the thermostat a little higher without telling him. "Good night, Peter," Chuck said. "Call us if you need anything." On the next Tuesday evening, Jeremy Haynes from Fish and Game came into the garage, stomped snow off his boots just inside the door, well away from the workstations. His own father had done taxidermy and processing. He knew to keep a shop clean. "Hey, Chuck, pretty good season so far, hey? Every deer butcher I know's got the lights on every night." "Yeah, I'm running probably 400 or 500 pounds a week right now. Logbook's over next to the door if you want to have a look." Jeremy wandered over, browsed through the book, wrote down the total number of deer by sex in a little pocket notebook. "Wow, can't believe old Leo got an 8-pointer," he said. 180 pounds. Most years he'd be lucky to bring back rabbits." "Yeah, well, God provides for the blind and the foolish," Chuck said, and they both laughed. Jeremy sat the book back on the shelf. "See much no-tag this year?" "Yeah, I had one kid from down by Elmira come through with a doe a couple of weeks ago. Claimed he'd lost his tag in the woods. I told him I couldn't help him." "You remember his name?" "Nah, afraid I didn't ask. Sorry." Jeremy nodded, zipped his parka back up to the top. "That's all right. Didn't expect you would. We each got our own jobs to do, hey?" On his way out, he said, "Keep on helping out the blind and the foolish, all right?" That's our story for the week.
Off Tag, part of the series A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Thanks for listening, and we'll look forward to you being back with us again next week at Stout Audio.